Now, Ambrose's gloss and Romans 1:32 were cited by some 10th and 11th century Christian reformers, notably Fulbert of Chartres and Peter Damian. But intensive theoretical attention to consent as a feature of how persons interact in groups really intensified in the mid to late 12th century. And this development was centered in two places, in Bologna, which was the center of canon law teaching, and in Paris, in the Theological School of Paris, which focused in unprecedented ways on practical moral questions, on the one hand, and on deriving innovative solutions to them from biblical exegesis on the other. So that's been studied by John Baldwin and Philippe Buch, whereas the canon law material has really been studied by Brian Tierney and Ken Pennington. Peter Clark, another key scholar here, may be correct that this intensified interest in consent was a response to new lay forms of social organization that challenged ecclesiastical thinkers to think about social communities in new ways. He's certainly right that exegesis and legal commentary were entwined rather than separate. Pope Innocent III spent time in both Paris and Bologna before he became pope, and consent theory heavily influenced his legislative innovations as pope, whether he derived it from Hugo Guccio or from Peter the Chanter. More likely, he derived it from both, for they were saying many of the same things. In response to a cluster of similar issues that emerge in the course of biblical or legal commentary, these writers quoted Paul, Ambrose, Augustine, and a growing trail of their own biblical examples and legal citations to assert that groups ranging from the people present at the sentencing of Christ, onlookers when a cleric is attacked, especially the murder of Thomas Becket, the sons of heretics, or the subjects of a ruler placed under interdict by the Pope, are all guilty, or at the very least responsible, for the sin they witness because they have consented to it by remaining silent. Thus, they deserve punishment with a like penalty, even when they did not participate in any way, and even when they were unable to prevent the sin, provided that they knew about it and kept silent. So here's where the cum possis clause comes into play, and here's where the contrast between mum, who remains silent or flatters, and the sozedger, who speaks the truth, is crucial. To be considered culpable for somebody else's sin, you don't need to have had the power to prevent it, but only the capacity to speak against it. Yet, who has that capacity? Rather than a fixed question, this was an active debate, vigorously pursued with various qualifications and limitations through biblical and canon law commentaries, and, as we'll see, in Mum and the Sozedger as well. Most of this development of legal and moral opinion took place rapidly between 1150 and 1250, and especially just before and during the pontificate of Innocent III. Some, such as Gratian, held that only prelates were required to correct the sins of others. Others, such as Peter the Chanter, Stephen Langton, Huguccio, Laurentius Hispanus, Johannes Teutonicus, and Innocent III himself, held everyone responsible and argued that the common people had the power to intervene by virtue of their numbers. Imagine someone saying that. There's a lot of them, so they can resist. Maybe not right after the peasants' revolt. Or even perhaps their prior consent to their ruler's reign, under the Roman Lex Regia, by virtue of which the ruler rules with his people's consent. So none of these thinkers went so far as explicitly to advocate open revolt by the people against the ruler, though only a few of them explicitly denied it either. But they and contemporary chroniclers did urge or describe the persuasive power of the clamor of public protest. By the time qui tacit consentire videtur is listed as a legal principle in the glossa ordinaria to the decretals in the, oh no, sorry, it's in the Liber Sextus, but this is actually its first citation. So this is the Smithfield decretals, and you can see, is that in the right place? Look at that.
Yeah.
It's moved. So it's actually just above qui tacit consentire videtur. So this is in the glossa ordinaria to the decretals. This is the first time it appears in canon law in the 1240s or so. We don't know exactly when this gloss was written, but this is the first time we have it recorded, again, around the middle of the century. So by the time it gets here, this is a key point, now that I've finished fiddling around with the slide. Okay, the ambiguity about the meaning of silence suggested by the word videtur, it seems, leaves no ambiguity at all. It is enough even to seem to consent, because the culpability of silence is all about appearances. One must speak the truth one knows before an audience, large or small, in order to refuse consent to it. And one must explicitly refuse consent in order to avoid culpability. So let's return to my initial question. Now that we have some sense of the common speech of qui tacit consentire videtur in the present, and also of its past, why does it matter that this legal maxim is presented here in Mum and the Sausager as a kind of proverbial common speech of the country, as well as Latinate book learning that can be construed by learned clerics? I want to suggest that when a learned cleric with extensive legal training, like the author of this poem, imagines that the common people this theory invokes, but rarely if ever engages, are themselves learned proponents of consent theory. Now they're his interlocutors and the potential recipients of his poem, then it limits what he can suggest to them that they should do. It is no longer possible, if qui tacit consentire videtur is common speech in the country, to skirt the question of how the common people might behave if they were explicitly told that they should protest clamorously or prevent their king from acting as he does by means of their mass strength, particularly maybe in the early Lancastrian years, when heads were hopping off on the green, as the poem says. Since Mum and the Sausager is not yet as widely read as Beowulf or the Canterbury Tales, I should tell you more about it before we dive in. So you have a plot summary on the handout, but I'm just going to course you through it very briefly. The poem begins partway through a description of the various officers who serve the king, ending with the conviction that the most valuable of them is the Sausager, if one could only be found. The clerk's unwanted advice, he pops up and starts talking, followed by an altercation with Mum, set the narrator off on a quest for the Sausager that is partly introspective, partly a physical journey that traverses the country, even if it focuses on population-dense institutions in towns, cities, and religious houses. Sometimes the narrator describes encounters with persons and personified qualities. Sometimes he recounts them in direct speech. His tone varies from gently ironic, as when a university master informs him that clerks at the university know about nothing except good governance until some of them pass forward into the service of lords, to bitingly satirical, as when he describes how friars' lies have led them to loll by the neck. Like Will and Piers Plowman, the narrator's frequently disoriented and full of questions. The bulk of his visits are to clerical institutions until Mum advises him to avoid the clergy, who can be dangerous, and try towns instead. Where after a quick tour of secular estates, he finds the cowed Sausager hiding in a shop, salving his wounds. Certain now that the Sausager is better than Mum, but still unsure of his way forward, he wanders out of town and falls asleep in a ditch. A deeply ironic location if you think about the both who fall in a ditch tag, right? Where he dreams a marvelous dream. So we're now halfway through the poem and we still haven't even gotten to a dream. That's an obvious difference from Piers Plowman. The dream's idealized natural setting is a fruitful landscape disposed for human enjoyment, in which he finds a garden cultivated by a franklin whose freehold it is. The franklin treats him to an extended allegorical description of the ideal society of bees, which is kind of a topos of political theory, nonetheless imperiled by the depredations of drones, who sound a lot like the friars the narrator has already criticized at length, and who he's squashing with his thumb when the narrator wanders up. The franklin follows up with a lengthy condemnation of Mum and his corrosive social effects, and by telling the narrator which way to go. He needs to find the court of the Sausager in his own heart, and let nothing hinder his making of books. So the narrator wakes up and unknits a whole bag of books that Mum and the friars have been hiding for years. And the rest of the poem, which breaks off unfinished, is a kind of inventory of the contents of this bag of books. Each of these books is itself, or leads to a description of, some social abuse associated with a particular status in society. So I think you can already see from this summary that Mum and the Sausager is perhaps Piers Plowman's most assiduous imitator, most fully emulating Piers Plowman's sprawling range of genres and literary devices and its experimentations with voice. And as in Piers Plowman, as in the passage from Mum that we've already looked at, it matters crucially what people know or think they know and how they know it. So this isn't the only passage where that's the case. knowledge acquired by some sort of natural process, as when Hoso Will learns about qui tacit consentire videtur just by talking with the neighbors, is counterposed to clerical book learning in both poems. And in both poems, this is done so in terms that don't unequivocally value either of them. Piers, as you'll remember from Piers Plowman in the first quotation here, makes his first appearance when the would-be pilgrims are blundering around, looking for a guide on their journey to St. Truth. Piers claims that he knows truth as keenly or as naturally as a cleric does his books. This is one of several quotations from Piers Plowman that Mum and the Soseger appropriates and redeploys for ironic effect. So the clerk, in the second quotation, who is the Mum narrator's first interlocutor, similarly comments that all the great clerks who dwell with the king know to avoid truth-telling at all costs. And they know that as keenly as a clerk does his books. For a clerk to compare clerks who have disdained truth with a clerk who knows books puts in question the process and results of book learning even more thoroughly than Piers did. Later on, in the next quotation, as the Mum narrator is falling asleep, he recalls this moment. And within the dream, the Franklin will strongly contradict the clerk. But the society of bees in the bottom quotation that the Franklin describes, too, Canoan as keenly as cleric doth his books, wastors, wasters, who wearken not but womans for to fill it. Yet in the wake of this idealized description of bees who seem to know how to get rid of wasters, we discover from the Franklin that bees are not good at all at recognizing the wasters among them. And that's why they need his thumb. They need external regulation to maintain proper functioning. Common speech, in some ways, but not all, is Mum and the Soseger's counterpart to the kind knowing of truth that we find in Piers Plowman. Common, as a description of speech, collocates alliteratively with Kuntre to describe true common speech in one other passage. In the inventory of the bag of books near the end of the poem, right near the end, the common tale of the country, that's in red. The common tale of the country witnesses to the suffering of those who bear the brunt of legal abuses. Here, the common tale accurately describes the oppression of its speakers. The poor are quite right to be bitter, and the law deserves its poor reputation at this moment. But other moments where the poet evokes a common voice in between these two examples near the beginning and the end of the poem are of sharply different kinds. The first imagines what a common voice might sound like if it were shared in an ideal society. We're back to the bees. We keep coming back to the bees. Rather than associated especially with the lower classes. In the Franklin's description of the bumbling of his bees, common and clerical knowledge once again concur. All of the bees know their... Whoops, this didn't switch. What's going on here? There we go. I don't know why it jumped. Okay, so the Latin of the bees in the third line. All the bees know their didina. So this means Latin in early Middle English. In late Middle English, it retains this resonance, but it really means any voice or language. They know their language. They know their voice. The bees' common voice is a sort of a liturgical resonance. It's raised in song morning and evening. It follows upon their orderly communal work in the various occupations required for their common good and just precedes what I've given you here. The description of their virtuous, meek, and merciful king, who rules them justly by their unanimous consent in the last line. Their company encloses all in one, just as their common voice does. But a common voice, which you've already seen, because I clicked twice, a common voice of a very different kind appears only shortly before the common tal of legal abuses that I showed you before. This is the language of rumor, which distorts truth not like Mum through flattery in pursuit of self-interest, but through fear or malice, as its participants give voice to their unhappiness by complaining about taxes. These two widely separated passages first describe rumor up here, and then, 50 lines later, condemn it. I think I should read these because they're important. Yet is there a copy for commons of Coolness 24, who some tell in teetings at home upon their benches, or else at Abe after supper, or early at an all, and lean on the lords, laurels and none other. Their towels been so trouble that torn in men's thoughts, the more that men musen on them, the madder they been after. Lazing's been so swift a foot, they lapen be the skies, and as swift as a swallow, shooting oot at owners, as falsely forged as though a frere had mad them. Then after Genghis Khan, new be Christ that may create, he cannot bethink a kindly cause, we, the common, should contra the king's will, no construe his workers. E carp not of knifts that cometh for the shears, that the king claypeth to conceal with other, but it longeth to no labourer. The law is again. Thus clappeth the common and knocketh themself, for the tale of their talking taineth them oft. So, it's a convention of estate satire, a genre that this inventory of books borders on, to blame every social status it surveys for some characteristic fault. At first, we might take the poem at its word here and associate malicious rumor against the king, especially with the lower classes, who are sharply reminded to keep their place and maintain obedience. That's what most critics have done. But this is to minimize the corrosive power of rumor by attributing it to a single class, as its description here only partly does. Friars too spread rumors, were reminded here. That's why they were lulled by the neck in their earlier satirical description. In the longer description of how rumor passes, that falls in the middle of the first passage, the copy for commons passage, the route the reader's encouraged to follow in testing the speed of rumor is the one that, in fact, disseminated copies for commons. Official and unofficial reports of parliamentary business, both written and oral, riding running from London to the Land's End from the King's Court and Council, from prelates to peers. Here the poet's complaining about misinformation that spreads faster than official news, but rumor spreads not only among common people, but among everyone. What was spoken and made out of the words in Parliament is reported orally and in written documents, following the same route as speculations about what wasn't. So as work by Matt Giancarlo, William Dodd, and Clementine Oliver has shown, rumor about the king's conduct and decisions is especially associated, despite the narrator's refusal of this interpretation, with the parliamentary commons, and with the clerics and servants who prepared documents and told stories about its proceedings, and disseminated these to the shires from which the knights came. Given his detailed knowledge of parliamentary proceedings, in fact, it's very possible that the author of this poem belonged to this class. And we should remember, too, that in the description of various officers who serve the king with which the poem begins, common talk about taxes, common clamor, and cree. Did I jump one? No? What's going on with my PowerPoint? It's really hard not being able to see it in front of me. That's not the right one. There we go. That's the right one. I don't know what's going on. We should remember, too, that in the description of the various officers who serve the king with which the poem begins, common talk about taxes and common clamor and crea are presented not as malicious rumor, but as an important and crucial source of truth that the king is denied because he lacks a sosegeri. My point, though, is not that the mum poet is inconsistent or confused. That's a point that's been made over and over again in the criticism of this poem. Rather, I'm trying to show that he imitates Piers Plowman's approach to sites of cultural tension more thoroughly than we've realized. In considering what role common speech might play in truth-telling, and to and by whom it should be spoken, he proceeds through episodic variation. He juxtaposes genres, conventions, literary devices, and institutionally specific discourses without resolving away their discords, in order to present as fully as he can a larger cultural incoherence about common speech. Another of these literary devices appears, sandwiched in between the poem's description of how rumors about the king fly among the commons and its claim that only shire knights, parliamentary commons, should speak against the king, while laborers remain silent so as not to distract lords from the defense of the realm. In between, let's make sure we get the right one. I seem to be getting random quotations when I click. That is not the right one. Max, how could this be happening? How is it skipping my quotations? It seems to be randomizing the order.
We could restart it if you'd like.
Let me see if I can find the one I want rather than doing that. Oh. No, you know what? You know what the problem is? I'm just going to leave it. Okay. In between, positioned as an illustrative digression, I apologize for technical difficulties. It's my least favorite part of other people giving talks. Is the poem's most elaborate exemplar, the story of Genghis Khan's rise to power, in which he quells dissension among the seven kingdoms he's been asked to rule by asking their rulers to kill their heirs and grant their lands to him. Consenting to his covetise with Kriya, Alat Ones, consenting to his covetousness with a mass outcry, they kill their sons, whereupon he returns their lands, though not their sons, and goes on to regain their conquered territory and much more. So in this exemplar, it's hard to see how the unanimous consent of Genghis's kings is exemplary. The desires it serves and their results are not presented as praiseworthy, even if their unanimity might be, but rather, as Ruth Nassay has argued, as an example of Oriental despotism. The point of connection between the tale and its launching point, here and elsewhere, is over a question of consent. But as with the drones of the hive squashed by the beekeeper, as with the foretold or recalled beheadings and hangings that pepper the poem, the level of violence the story requires in order to arrive at consensus is disquieting, to say the least, as is the fear that consensus arrived at through this level of sanctioned public retribution against deception and division will be at least as violent in response to unwelcome truths. To present kings as examples of proper conduct to laborers complaining about heavy taxes disrupts the differential entitlement to public complaint depending on status that the whole surrounding passage was endeavoring to set up. And maybe that's the point. If so, this is one of several places in the poem where an illustrative tale seems to unravel hierarchical claims and make them universal. The poem has it both ways. On the one hand, it's exquisitely attentive to and worried about how status and social position give persons the capacity to speak and write truth, or else keep silent, flatter, or lie. Yet the more that truth-telling attends to those circumstances of truth, the more it resembles mumming. On the other hand, the poem complicates each of its circumstance-specific accounts through illustrative tale-telling, babbling, as it's called at one point, that opens up these capacities to everyone, rather than reserving them to those who are in a position to speak. So two such tales, we're returning to the Qui Tacit Consentire passage, which is where I'm going to end. Two such tales in rapid succession, one biblical and one a similitude, here we get number one, drawn from country life, introduce the presentation of Qui Tacit Consentire videtur as common speech, from which we began. Prelates are the problem here in this larger passage, and it is mum, in a rare instance of low-stakes truth-telling, for the narrator presents no threat whatsoever to him, who is explaining the problem. So I'm going to read each of these two exempla to you and then discuss them. Pilate in the Passion, among all the people, willed after Watra to wash with his handas to shew him, be that senior of the blood-shedding of Christ that is crayed and on the cross dead, his conscience was cleansed as clean as his handas. Yet was he groomed of the gram and most guilty ache, for every man that meaned hath may well weet that prelates often have pite when prince be moved, and raid them so that rancun wrote not in heart. Immediately following the second example, for who hath knowledge of a clue because of above, and will stand still till the storm fall, and wend not of the wheat way, the wheat is his own. Though it hailed on his head, who is to blame? For who has seeked of a shore that sharply ariseth, and will not cast him to cave with covering above till it drop Ala Doon and doom wet him mock, and ache fall on his friend, in faith as may thinketh he is after of all the harm and the awk, and so privy to the pains that pairs endure. So some vernacular speech. Everyone gets wet as shit in the rain if they're stupid enough to stand under a cloudburst that they can see is coming. It'll fall on their friends, too, and that'll be their fault. Similarly, prelates who fail to correct the king when he's considering a case that involves capital punishment are liable to get soaked with guilt along with everyone else, even if they leave Parliament as the case is being considered. But this similitude works against its focus. Given that everyone gets wet in the rain, it's hard to avoid the conclusion that everyone ought to correct the king. What's more, the metaphorical action in the similitude works against its proposed moralization. Avoiding showers by running for cover sounds a lot more like mum than like the sausager, and it sounds like exactly what the prelates are in fact doing, fleeing Parliament. Pilate's washing of his hands might seem to be a contrary example. As was the case with Genghis's seven kings, the disparity of status between Pilate and the prelates might seem to limit the analogy. Pilate's a Roman governor, while the prelates merely advise the king. Yet, Pilate's status as the most guilty, let me just go back to that quotation for you, as the most guilty of the sin he does not himself commit, but does not use his authority to prevent, is another indication that the mum poet is closely familiar with consent theory. An influential gloss, which I'll show you and paraphrase but not read to you, so you can get to reading the Latin starting right at the top if you want. An influential gloss on Book 1, Title 29, Chapter 1 of the Decretals distinguished different kinds of consent and assigned greater guilt to those authorizing or defending sin by virtue of their greater power. It's clear that the doers of and consenters to sin are constrained by equivalent penalties, says the glossator, but we should note that consent is of four kinds: negligence, counsel, cooperation, and authorization or defense. A negligent person sins less, unless his negligence is especially gross, as might be the case for prelates. Someone who provides counsel similarly incurs a lesser punishment, but still more than someone who's just negligent. Yet, someone who acts together with the sinner merits the same penalty, as the letter by Alexander III suggests. And finally, someone who authorizes or defends a sin is more guilty and deserves a heavier punishment by virtue of their authority. In this sense, the difference of status between Pilate and the prelates is insignificant to the mum poet's point, since both have the authority to speak out. But another complication is that Pilate, like the man and his friends who are wet as shit in the rain, is an exemplary figure with yet wider scope. In the commentary tradition, both biblical and legal, Pilate's often presented as an example not just for rulers or their high-ranking peers, but for everyone. So consider, for example, going right back to the 12th century, this example from Peter the Chanter, from the Verbum Abbreviatum, so a moral manual of popular moral theology designed for preachers, in which he presented many of the key tenets that he developed in his biblical commentaries for a wider audience. Each member of the whole should speak out against sin. All are guilty, not just the person who commits the act. Peccatum unius redundat in unum versus, totum unus quisque, qui potus debet resistere et contradictere vel impedire. Otherwise, you're like Pilate. Anyone who thinks he's excluded is like Pilate or like Saul. While Peter the Chanter goes further than most in explicitly authorizing everybody, totum unus quisque, to speak against the sin they would otherwise be implicated in, I'd just like to point out in passing, too, that I'm not oblivious to the anti-Semitism lurking here in the exegetical tradition of blaming all the Jews for the death of Jesus. Here especially, it's obvious that consent theory is a double-edged sword. It authorizes, it also blames. Let's back up finally from Qui tacit consentere videtur and its textual surroundings to recall, if you look at your handout, the bolded passages, that this is not the poem's only Latin tag, reinforcing the uncompromising position that to remain silent in the face of wrong is to participate in it, even if it's the only one to be incorporated within a verse line. These quotations, like the poem's status-disrupting descriptive and narrative digressions, contrapuntally puncture the poem's intermittent approval of consensus achieved through violence, and Hedging's round of true speech with conditions, even if they have no impact on its aspirations toward the possibility of a truly common speech, like that of the bees morning and evening, or the learned and the common people together voicing their conviction that qui tacet, consentire videtur. Despite these moments of aspiration toward common voice, though, Mamma the Sausager, as it remains to us, more than any poem in the Piers Plowman tradition, seems to aspire to something like that poem's difficult balance between irreconcilable attempts at truth. This poem, too, melds together genres and discourses, narrative strategies, allegory and exemplum and similitude. This poem, too, stages debates and voices views that it does not hold. It's as multivocal and as repeatedly revised and unfinished and incomplete as Piers Plowman, perhaps more so. So let me end with a plea to this poem's growing fan base, to which I hope I've added you, not to treat it reductively by assuming that it means what it says, but to allow it, like the versions of the poem that it emulates and imitates and responds to unfurl the full extent of its ambivalence about the questions it raises. More than any other poem or sermon about consent theory, that's a big claim, Fiona, I'd better back that up. Mamma the Sausager presents to us a vacillation, a squeamishness about the violence that may be done in the name of consent, both when it's assumed or asserted on behalf of others who are not allowed to speak, and when it's affirmed or denied in one's own voice. We should reflect that that's quite a literary achievement. Thank you.
We have a short period of time for questions, after which we'll break into, usually we have a roundtable session, which more kind of extended conversation afterwards. So if anyone has any questions.
Thank you, everyone. And, I'm sorry that I had problems with the PowerPoint. I'm used to having it here. I've cowed them all into silence.
Is there just one unicum of source for this poem?
Yeah, all we have is this little, like a paperback size notebook on parchment, limp parchment binding. Incomplete at the beginning and end, frayed margins, that's all we've got.
And we don't know anything about the provenance? Or...
No, nothing. It's in a Bristol language, like the poem Richard the Redless, and some people have suggested that they might be by the same poet, but Mamma the Sausager is considerably more sophisticated in its in the way it pitches its political critique. Richard the Redless has the luxury of being written after Richard dies, and so it can just complain, and it lets rip. There's some wonderful lines complaining about Richard and his court. But this poem is much more tempered. Of Chaucer in this poem, and I also see echoes of the Pearl Poem. So I think that this poem presents us with more evidence that these people were really
just wondered if, you show beautifully how this poem takes off from Piers Plowman. I just wondered if another possible inspiration, a similar legal maxim, also I think appended to Gratian, necessitas non habet legem, which Langland explores in Passus
at considerable length. Yeah.
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 And I just wonder if that's another sort of inspiration for the mum poet.
I do think so, and does Matt have a chapter on non habet legem in his book? Somebody, maybe it's Clementine Oliver. Somebody has written a chapter recently that talks a lot about that maxim. Is it? It's in Matt's?
Matt talks a little bit about it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I mean, particularly the emphasis on the poor in the poem does seem to tend in that direction. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so he doesn't quote it. It's intriguing that he quotes so many maxims that are about consent, but he has lots more maxims that I haven't listed here.
But that's another of these maxims that seems to get out into common speech, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, that one definitely does. I'm not sure that qui tacit consentere videtur does before the internet,
right.
But need hath no law definitely does.
Yes, it does. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. It's really intriguing that in the recent editions of this poem, they print all the Latin in the margin in the text in the same way that Piers Plowman has passages of Latin interspersed into the text. But the Piers Plowman manuscripts present the Latin continuous with the poem. This poet seems to be doing something different. And it makes the poem look more like Piers Plowman when you incorporate the Latin into the text. But the qui tacit consentire videtur is actually the only place where you get the Latin actually in the line, in the same way as in Piers Plowman.
Yeah. I know you covered a little bit of this, but I was wondering if, in the beginning you were talking about defining certain terms, what does it mean to have the capacity to speak? I was wondering, if you could explain a little bit what it means to contradict. I mean, can you write a poem that's ambivalent about a policy? Does that count as a contradiction, or does contradiction require me standing up in front of people and saying, I don't like this one particular policy?
That's a beautiful question. I mean, is Mummon so center exonerating itself from the abuses it describes, given that it's so mealy about it?
Yeah.
That's a beautiful question. I wish I could ask the Mummon poet whether he thought he'd contradict. I think that the reason why the videtur becomes almost meaningless in the sense that it might seem to introduce an ambiguity in the sense that you only seem to consent. Whether you really consent is a matter for your conscience and something that nobody knows about. There seems to be a demand of explicit witnessing, right? You actually have to say you don't agree. You have to say it. You can say it just to the person who committed the sin. You don't have to do it in public. You're saying it to them in private is enough. But you actually have to explicitly disagree. And that would seem to rule out kneeling as a contradiction or ambivalence. I'm not sure if it would in the mind of the monocle at those moments where he seems to be uncompromising. Because he has uncompromising moments, and he has moments where he seems deeply troubled by the consequences of people acting in that way. And what he's doing is he's juxtaposing different kinds of discourses about truth and different kinds of genres in which people talk about this next to each other. Because he's not sure. So it depends what mood he's in, or what genre he's in.
Well, that seems like
one
a good...
More.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
sorry.
That was great. And I was thinking about Matt's book a couple times when you were talking.
Yeah.
And thinking about the way that he's interested in the difficult politics of bringing contradictory voices together with some kind of coherent comments, right? And just listening to John's question here, do you think is part of the difficult energy around speech and silence here also coming from thinking about that parliamentary force as a problematic model? Because it sounds to me, as long as I've read this, but the parliament is all over this in a way that more so perhaps than Piers Plowman. That's an institution
that
we're really thinking a lot about.
He's thinking about parliament and about specific actions the parliament has taken in quite a bit of detail. He keeps returning to parliament and blaming parliament for not bringing forward the complaints of the common people. So he sees it as a machine that's the only machine we've got, but that's not working.
Yeah.
And it's not working largely because of the corrosive force of flattering speech
right.
and sounds. So it's Mum's fault.
Yeah. Well, that makes a lot of sense behind the poem that would then be so ambivalent in the end about what the solution needed.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I love Matt's reading. It's really great.
Well, there's no other burning questions. This seems like a good time to break. We'll pull a few tables together and we'll have a roundtable session to talk more in depth about this talk or the topics that's brought up in context. Before we do so, if we could all give another hand to